This is an ABC podcast.
How meaningful is your work? Or is work just work? To finish as soon as you can so you can just get on with life. According to ABC's national survey of 54,000 people for the Australia Talks project, jobs are very important for our self-image if we're younger than 65. And for many of us, finding fulfilment at work is something we rate very highly indeed. Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and for this episode of This Working Life, we go on a search for meaning. With me, we have Peggy Kern, she's Associate Professor in Positive Psychology at the University of Melbourne, and Nina Mapson-Bone, Managing Director of Recruitment Company Beaumont People. We should start off by talking about the word meaningful. Peggy, what is meaningful work?
So meaningful work really comes down to this idea of it fulfills us, it gives us a sense of identity, and we really find a purpose and value in what we do.
Sounds pretty individual.
Individual in terms of what gives us meaning. And so different jobs are going to be meaningful for different people. Even in the same job, different people will find things meaningful. So for some, it might be the relationships that they have with others. For others, it's actually the contribution that we do through our work. So even within the same job, different people can find different things that are really meaningful. But a lot of it is how it really connects to what we really care about, who we are, our values. But it's what really fills us up, gets us out of bed each day, and really says, you know, this is what I'm all about.
What does the research tell us about what are meaning destroyers?
The things that destroy meaning.
Yeah.
So some things are definitely being in a place where it's a misfit for your real interests. We see a lot of young people who are pushed into a certain profession, perhaps her family expectations or whatnot, and they might get down to about in their 30s or 40s, and all of a sudden they're like, what am I doing with my life? I perhaps am making a lot of money, but what's it all for? It's just a misfit for their real values and what they really care about. The other thing we can see is over-passion about work. And so we can get over into our work in a way that actually becomes really off-balanced. And so then I'm sacrificing my family. I'm sacrificing other parts of life such that you become a real workaholic. And that really becomes undermining of something that might have actually been very meaningful in the first place, but also can destroy that. Another one that we see is just sort of institutional pressures and things that start to take the joy out of a job in terms of what brought someone there in the first place.
Nina Mapson-Bone, you've recently embarked on some research of your own around this notion of meaningful work. Why did you decide this sort of survey was needed?
We see candidates every day looking for new roles, looking for organisations, and we get to hear firsthand why they're maybe a bit unhappy or what they're looking for. And we felt there was a real need to create more opportunities for meaningful work. And when we looked into it, we realised that there was no Australia-specific research into meaningful work, and there's also no integrated approach worldwide. So the research that we've asked the Inclusive Foundation to do for us has really the first time that anywhere researchers looked at what is meaningful for the individual, but also from a job perspective, an organisation perspective, and a societal perspective. So we're really excited about what that's going to show.
And you didn't just cover employees, you covered employers as well. Why was that?
Because we felt that there was potentially a gap. We wanted to explore that gap. What might be meaningful to me, as Peggy was just saying, might be very different to Peggy or to yourself, Lisa. But also what the organisation provides in terms of meaning may not match what I'm looking for. And we see, we do a lot of work in the charity sector. We see, for example, a lot of people will join a charity because they have an alignment with the meaning of the purpose. But then when they get into the role, sometimes they find that maybe the culture's not right or something's a bit different to what they were expecting. And so the meaning isn't personal to them sometimes. So we wanted to see if we could find a way to bridge that gap between organisations and individuals.
Peggy Kern, this search for meaning in our working lives, how much of it is it a relatively modern phenomenon?
It's an interesting question. I mean, it certainly seems that people are talking about that idea of meaning and wanting their job to actually matter for something much more than in prior generations. And it might be just that it's more visible. So it's just sort of part of the sort of common conversation now. Some of it might also have to do with sort of the changing kind of roles that we have in our work, we've seen a real shift from more industrial jobs that are very much about, it's just a paycheck and you're going there, you work 9 to 5 and then you go home. So job is just one part of your life that kind of allows the other parts of life. And what we're seeing now is much more technological, cognitive jobs, things that require things like people skills, creativity, and whatnot. It's a very different workplace. And as part of that, work becomes so much more a part of our lives and part of our identity. In many ways, for many people, the 9 to 5 job doesn't actually exist anymore.
And Peggy, I heard a theory that in the past we may have found meaning from other areas of our life, for example, going to church, volunteering. Do you think this might play a part in this at all?
It does play a part. I mean, we're seeing various shifts in society. So it used to be community played a very big part in things. And we still see that in some communities. Things like families. Well, now you're seeing a lot of people living on their own or very, very mobile. So we don't have those same connections oftentimes that we used to have. And so then the workplace actually becomes one of those core places to actually fill some of those needs that I might have filled in other areas previously.
Nina, I know you've just in the preliminary stages of looking at your survey results, but we want hot off the press. What has your survey found so far? Any surprises there?
Well, just really to touch on some of the things that Peggy has been saying, just some of the themes that seem to be coming through are that the engagement with others, the collaboration with others, that seems to be very high up the list. And it does seem to be replacing some of that community aspect that perhaps has been lost in the past. The piece around leadership and culture, those kind of themes are coming through very strongly. So there seems to be a real shift towards the, I guess, the more positive side of workplaces rather than just things like pay. And the other thing I would say is that there definitely seems to be a theme of it being more important now than it was 5 years ago. So we're definitely seeing that trend come through.
The ABC's Australia Talk survey drilled down a little bit on the demographics, and it found that the more money people earn, the more they wanted to enjoy their job and find fulfillment in it. So is this a socioeconomic desire? Is this a question of privilege then, Peggy?
It is possible that it could be, and there's been a few studies coming out of the States that actually point to the idea that actually this whole idea of even caring about meaning actually says you actually have a certain amount of privilege, and it's not just getting by in life at that point. Some of the meaning research actually might suggest this element of even the search for meaning doesn't actually matter if you're actually just trying to get food on the table or fulfill your basic needs or even get employed in the first place. Everyone should have that ability to have the meaningful job, but for many, that might not actually be possible. And if I want to pursue a meaningful job and that's actually not open to me for whatever reason, then it could actually be quite detrimental if I'm always searching for meaning and actually I just need a job instead.
Nina, what do you think? Is it more difficult to talk about meaningful work if you're struggling, you know, with a low wage or even looking for a job at all?
Well, one of the things that I think will be interesting over time with the research we're doing is that we will be able to break that down and see. You know, we're not there yet, but we're hoping over time as we build more and more into the research we're doing that we'll be able to see if there's a difference between those seeking work versus those in work versus even economic times. You know, our plan is to continue this research over a number of years so that we can see in good economic times or bad economic times if people's priorities change around whether it's contribution or leadership or whether pay becomes more important at that point in time. So I think that will be a really interesting thing to look for, to see what the dynamic is there. But for me, the point is that meaningful work can mean different things to different people, and it can change over the course of your lifetime. And that's okay. And part of this is about recognizing where are you at as an individual and how do you align that with the kind of work you're looking for.
Once again, in the Australia Talks survey, there are also differences in terms of ages. So young people felt strongly that they'd be happier if they had a better job, and the majority of those under 50 agreed. The survey showed that as we get older, we're actually happier with our jobs. Peggy, what's going on there?
We do see this in other research outside of the workplace, is that there's a strange paradox that as people get older and they actually start losing connections and have more health problems and whatnot, they actually report higher well-being oftentimes as well. There's a lot of exceptions of that. So you do have a lot of cases of mental illness and things like that as well. Some of it might be things don't matter as much. So you start to learn kind of how to find value in things. You also tend to, a lot of people have a better sense of who they are what they actually really care about, become more purposeful about choosing what matters in life, as opposed to things that many of our young adults are actually searching for who they are. And they're actually trying to figure out what their identity is and what they actually really value. And so there can be much more of that search there.
Nina, are we sometimes expecting too much from our jobs, do you think? Or is it fair that we spend so much time at work so we should feel fulfilled?
What I think is interesting is in terms of the expectation, and this aligns perhaps to the age thing, is that I think it's more that we don't know how to articulate what we want. I think a lot of people don't necessarily know for themselves what is meaningful for us. And I think that's something my view is that we might learn that over time, which is why we get better as we get older around kind of understanding and being comfortable with where we're at. And so the goal that we have is being able to find a way to help people articulate that better so that they can bring that into the conversation and in an interview or when they're talking to their boss about what the next steps might be or where they might develop their careers, they have a way of voicing that, but without it being sort of kind of threatening or if you don't give me this, I'm going to leave, or not knowing how to have that conversation. So I think defining meaningful work for people and helping them give voice to those parts will really make a big difference.
Peggy, are there things that we can do then on a personal level to bring more meaning to our working lives?
There are several different things that we can do. One is getting to know our own values and our own interests. So why am I at that job? And actually understanding what is it that actually either draws me there or at least drew me there in the past. So getting to know ourselves better and what we really value. A second thing is we can actually think about, are there ways we can actually craft our jobs in some ways? And this might be a conversation with a boss or an employer. You know, if you're a more relational person, are there ways you could actually be doing more relational tasks with people? Or if you're a person who actually prefers to be more working on your own more, could you be doing some of those more analytic tasks or whatever? So it might be actually doing more of the tasks that we actually want to do. And then also thinking about how I think about my job, what am I really contributing to, and getting to understand that better can help kind of fill us up a bit.
You use the word crafting, and there is a term called job crafting in research in this area. Should we all learn some skills here?
We do see the research, and that's where that comes from, is the job crafting research, and is really around a way to help create a more meaningful job. Now, the one challenge with job crafting is that I think those who have more status and power oftentimes have more ability and flexibility around making some of those choices. So for instance, if I do have more power in my position, I can actually craft my tasks and not do the things I don't want to do. But that might actually be making somebody else very unhappy if I dump all of that on them. So I think we want to be careful about not crafting our jobs in ways that actually really undermine the well-being and meaning of others in our organization.
Nina, what are your thoughts on this? Do we all have some power over finding fulfillment at work here?
I think we do. And I think Peggy's right in terms of our ability to craft our own roles and how much power we have over that. But I think there's also an additional element that we're seeing come through in the research. And that's some of the areas that we don't necessarily have the ability to craft. So things like the quality of the leadership, over which we have no control necessarily, the culture of the organization and how aligned that is to our values. And again, we don't necessarily as one individual have control over that, or even how much the organization contributes to society or to kind of the well-being of others. We're seeing a theme of the more an organization contributes externally, the more people are engaged, but we as an individual can't necessarily craft that part of it. So I think we have some control, but I think there's a piece that the organization needs to play in terms of helping shape the other part of the equation.
So Nina, what is the cost to employers if people don't find meaning at work?
Well, we know that when you have people working that aren't in meaningful work, that they're less productive. We know that they take more sick days, there's more absenteeism. We know that there's higher staff turnover. And we also know that they're less committed to the organisation. So in terms of how that all adds up, it's a significant economic cost to the organisations.
Thank you so much both for your thoughts, and I wish you both meaningful work.
Thank you.
Peggy Kern, who's Associate Professor in Positive Psychology at the University of Melbourne, and Nina Mapson-Bone, Managing Director of recruitment company Beaumont People. And if you missed the Australia Talks special on ABC TV last night, you can catch up on iView, and there's still time to head online and see how you compare to our survey results. It's a lot of fun filling out all those questions, I must say. We'll put a link to the Australia Talks online tool on our website. What's the state of your CV, if you even have one? Do you think it's a true reflection of your array of skills and what you can actually do? It's extremely hard to put down on paper the skills you've gained over your career, and sometimes a list of jobs and skills, which a CV so often is, just doesn't seem to cut it anymore. Kate Glazebrook is the CEO and co-founder of Applied, a tech startup that is using behavioural science and technology to circumvent the inherent biases that can come from scanning a CV. Welcome to This Working Life, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisa.
Kate, I wanted to start by asking you, what do we know about how CVs are used in recruitment at the moment?
Well, I guess there are two things we know. One is that they've basically been used in exactly the same way for the last 100 years, and that hasn't changed, which is kind of terrifying. But the other thing is that we increasingly understand the decision environment or the kind of psychological environment when people are reading CVs. So to the extent there's good data, it suggests that the average CV is read for as little as sort of 6 to 10 seconds.
Really?
Before, yeah.
That's very short.
Terrifying, right? I was the sort of person that used to spend ages, you know, labouring over sub-bullet point 2.1 on page 2 of my CV, thinking about like, wow, what's the best way of describing that job I used to do? When it turns out that no one's paying attention to that sub-bullet point 2.1 because they're not getting that far, they're reading your CV for about 6 to 10 seconds, which means they're reading a couple of things that sit at the top, which typically is your name and your address and a few other random pieces, and then bolded items. And then they're making a really quick decision, do I bring this person in for interview or not? So I guess from a behavioral science or psychological standpoint, that's a fascinating realization about what the brain is doing in those crucial 6 to 10 seconds.
What would you say is the problem then with making such a snap judgment on a CV?
Well, I guess there are two problems as we see it. The first is that CVs are riddled with opportunities for bias. So as I mentioned earlier, if someone's only spending 6 to 10 seconds looking at your CV, you want to be making sure that they're spending the time on the things that really matter. But what we've been able to show over about the last 40 to 50 years worth of research, where researchers have tested slight variants on effectively the same CV and have been able to uncover that even changes in your name change your rate of being called through to an interview. So they've been able to show, for example, in Anglo-Saxon countries that, you know, if you've got a non-Anglo or non-white sounding surname, you need to send between sort of 40 and 75% more CVs out to get the same rate of callback for interview, even if you're equally qualified for the job. So in the US, that is the equivalent of needing to have about 5 more years of job experience. So I guess one thing that we've discovered through CVs is that people are paying attention to things like your surname and ethnic associations when you finished university as a proxy for how old you are. And in fact, scarily, a study in Sweden even found that exactly the same qualified candidate, if they came from a lower socioeconomic part of Stockholm, was less likely to be selected than one from a richer part of Stockholm. So basically, we know people are paying attention to the wrong things. The second thing that I think CV evaluation has taught us is that actually even the things that we think are predictive of job performance, like where you went to university and what your job history looks like, just isn't actually as predictive of job performance as we might once have thought it was. So in our view, actually the CV is a very antiquated sort of artifact, and we need to move beyond them if we want to be making sure we're making the best selection of candidate that doesn't have bias.
So if it's our names and if it's our age and our gender, then what would we have on a CV? Or are you saying no CVs from now on?
I'm saying CVs might have some role to play, but they certainly shouldn't be used as the first thing that we select candidates on. If you look at most of the data out there about what is predictive of job performance, so there have been some meta-analyses that have pulled together, you know, of the litany of things we get put through when we go for jobs, you know, telling people every small detail about yourself, including the name of your first cat, to get a job. They've tried to kind of correlate all of those different types of assessments with actual on-the-job performance. And what they tend to find in these studies is that things that sit on CVs, like where you went to university or your years of education, years of work experience, actually hold only a correlation of sort of 0.1 with job performance, which is quite low.
It's tiny. So
it's tiny. It only, you know, represents about 10% of the variation in on-the-job performance. But the more that we can test candidates on things that they actually do in the day job in very practical scenario-based assessments, the closer we can get to understanding whether they're a good fit for that role. So what we do at Applied is actually replace the CV with job-based assessments that are real reflections of the kinds of challenges you might face in the role. And that becomes the method of deciding, do I bring this person into the next stage of the assessment?
And so is that role-playing or is that really on the job?
So it can be a variety of different things. Actually, we have everything from people looking at data sets and thinking about what kinds of inferences you could make from that if they're going for a hyper-analytical role, through to how would you deal with this really tricky work scenario, through to let's take a manager and you give them a particular situation and you say, write the email that you would send to your team explaining what has just happened. And what's really interesting about these kinds of small work-based assessments is that you pick up things that cannot be found out through a CV. So just knowing someone was previously a manager tells you nothing about whether they were a good manager. And in actual fact, most of what our days involve is communicating with other people, trying to be persuasive, using judgment. And actually, by using these work-based assessments, not only do you learn a bit about whether they have the content knowledge for the job, but you can also pick up on all of these more crucial sort of social skills. How do they write that email? What language do they use? Would you want to receive that email? What does it tell you about what they've prioritized? So you can actually learn a lot richer information while also making sure it's much more predictive of whether this person is a good fit.
I recently applied for a board position and I haven't really updated a CV in about 5 years because I use LinkedIn. What should I do about the fact that I was asked for a CV?
Well, I mean, the problem is that candidates are not usually in a position where they can dictate to the potential employer, I'd rather not send you a CV, but can I please do an interpretive dance for you?
Haven't you heard about the death of a CV?
Indeed. So I guess, you know, obviously we're big believers that we can move beyond the CV. And in fact, you know, there are many organisations that are being much more, you know, as the data has become much, much clearer that CVs are not the right way of making hiring decisions. And as I say, they're riddled with opportunities for bias, which matters a lot for organisations that are also under a lot more pressure, and rightly so, over diversity and inclusion. But, you know, if you are going to be asked to have a CV, think a lot about if you've got 6 to 10 seconds worth of somebody's attention, make sure you spend it wisely. So sadly, things like formatting makes a really big difference. What are you going to bold in that CV and what are you not? You know, previous titles we know gets paid attention to, as does education. So having a think about the kinds of things that you want to make salient in, you know, that very, very crucial amount of time that someone's likely to be evaluating you. That's
I was just going to put my name and age.
Yeah, you could do that.
I can just make the decision on that.
Exactly. I mean, you can also think about it as an opportunity. And I think, you know, we're seeing this sort of rise in people putting a little prelude at the top of their CVs about what they want to draw people's attention to. And of course, these things are also quite culturally different. You know, go to different parts of the world and the CV or resume looks really different. If you're in parts of continental Europe, for example, actually most applications they run to sort of 30 or 40 pages. And the expectation is that you supply, you know, copies of transcripts and every known assessment you've ever had in your life. And that's the assumption, whereas in other parts of the world, you know, a very short, snappy one-page CV is what is done. So I guess the other thing I would say, and this is particularly relevant for those of us in the economy that might be coming from elsewhere and want to be making sure we have the best shot at a job, if you are asked for a CV, do a little bit of research on what's most common in the context in which you are applying, because again, people have limited attention. They're often making very quick decisions. They might be making it sort of at 6 p.m. on a Friday afternoon and want to get to the end of that set of CVs that are sat in front of them. And you don't want to stand out for the wrong reasons, unfortunately.
And that is Kate Glazebrook, CEO and co-founder of Applied, and the recipient of the 2019 Advanced Technology Innovation Award that is granted to innovative Australians working internationally. What are your thoughts on meaningful work or the end of the CV? Let us know by email or voice memo. Just head to our program page. To support our show, please subscribe, rate and review. We love reading your reviews. Thanks to producer Kathy Pryor and our technical producer, Gareth Burnell. I'm Lisa Leong, and until next week, keep working.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.